Robert leapfrogged entirely the process of learning computers in school. The Delbarton School had early Apple computers, but from age 12 Robert had access to a machine 10 times more powerful. While the school was handing out computer achievement awards to other students for mastering the Apples, Robert was already writing complicated programs and technical papers. Yet few of Robert's friends and teachers at Delbarton even suspected that the diffident sophomore had such a level of expertise in computers. Robert had launched his computer career entirely from home. During Robert's senior year, Bob's old friend, Fred Gamp, hired Robert part-time at Bell Labs. Robert, at 16, behaved like any of the dozens of college students who took part-time jobs and internships at the labs. Unlike his father, he was inordinately quiet, but he shared his father's tremendous curiosity about the world around him. Robert had already made something of a name for himself at Bell Labs with his earlier unsanctioned tours of Bell Labs computers, but he was a hard worker. His project there was his own idea, to write a more secure and efficient implementation of UUCP, the program used for copying files from Unix machine to Unix machine. The challenge was to write a UUCP implementation that could cope with the volume and variety of traffic that had evolved on the network over the years. It's not every high school student who can redesign a major piece of software. Despite a few problems, Robert's program was so good that it became the model for UUCP that Bell Labs eventually adopted. He even produced a technical paper on results of his work titled Another Try at UUCP. Yet he wasn't single-minded in his devotion to computers. Robert distinguished himself early in other ways at Delbarton. He swam on the school team and sang with the chorus. Yet he remained shy and, as far as his parents could tell, still unaware of his intellectual gifts. So Anne took it upon herself to have a talk with the headmaster at Delbarton. She explained that she thought Robert might benefit from a boost from his superiors at school. Apparently in agreement with this concerned parent, the headmaster went out of his way to praise Robert in the presence of other students. On the day the school received the results of that year's SAT exams, the headmaster greeted Robert in the front hall of the school, and, in front of a dozen other students, told Robert that his scores, a perfect 800 in verbal and a 790 in math, were the highest in the school's history. From that point on, Robert's self-esteem seemed to soar. For college, he set his sights on Harvard. Not only had his father gone there, but for several generations back, the Tappans and the Farlows on Anne's side of the family had as well. Robert applied for early acceptance and got in. When Robert entered Harvard in the fall of 1983, he was still shy and socially awkward, but he knew of one place he could go where he would have a good chance at fitting in quickly, the Aiken Computation Laboratory. Most college campuses have a research computer center, distinct from where the university's own central data processing is performed. At Harvard, it's Aiken, which takes care of the computing needs of the university's Division of Applied Sciences. The central computer center, with operators who don't need to know much more than how to feed the printer, is across the campus at the Office of Information Technology. Aiken is a little faster and looser with its computers, and hence a more interesting place to work. When Robert arrived at Harvard, there was in fact no computer science department per se at the school. Instead, there was a computer science faculty, a group of 17 faculty members within applied sciences. Serious computer science students at Harvard gravitated more often than not toward Aiken, where computer science faculty spent their time. An all-brick monument to an architectural aesthetic grounded in common sense, Aiken stands diagonally across from the magnificent law school building on the law school quadrangle. Inside the Aiken lobby, spanning an entire wall, stands Howard Aiken's 51-foot-long, 8-foot-tall legacy to modern computing, the Mark I Automatic Sequence Controlled Calculator. During the 30s, the mathematics professor had a dream of building a large-scale calculator, a switchboard-mounted device that would do arithmetical operations without the intervention of an operator. In 1944, in collaboration with IBM, Aiken completed the Mark I, at a cost of $250,000. It was the world's first large-scale electric calculator. A typical problem that would have taken a team of 4 experts 3 weeks to solve occupied the machine for only 19 hours. By the late 1980s, a problem that would have really challenged the Mark I could be done in a second or two on a $40 programmable handheld calculator. Still, the Mark I was a revolutionary development in its time, and Aiken's place in the history of technology was duly secured inside the building named for him. Across from the Mark I is a glass-enclosed room of terminals and workstations, a place where students and Aiken staffers work. In 1983, the hardcore computer people at Aiken, who didn't have their own offices, spent most of their waking hours in the room, and others drifted in and out. In the 1950s, Bob Morris had also spent time at the computation lab helping to build the Mark IV, the fourth generation of Aiken's calculator. Shortly after arriving at Harvard, the younger Morris walked into the Aiken administrator's office and asked for an account on the lab's computer. Eleanor Sachs, the Aiken administrator, patiently explained that freshmen weren't given accounts at Aiken, that Aiken was the exclusive province of faculty and more advanced students. She gently told him to join the other freshmen a few doors down at the Science Center. But Robert didn't especially want to join the masses in the basement of the Science Center, a sea of computer terminals and personal computers that resembled a word processing pool more than a computer science lab. Not only was Aiken a more civilized place to sit and program, but there were more computer resources available there. But instead of trying to argue about it, Robert wandered back out of her office. A few days later, he took care of the problem himself by turning the Aiken VAX into a single-user machine, creating an account for himself, and then returning the VAX to multi-user status. His login, which he had used since the days on the Bell Labs computer, was RTM. Shortly thereafter, a faculty member who knew Bob Morris saw to it that Robert received a legitimate account. Nick Horton, the Aiken manager, knew little about Unix, and before long, Robert was a permanent fixture there. He wasn't one to learn a little about a lot of things. Like his father, Robert learned a lot about a lot of things. He could handle hardware emergencies as well as software problems. Once his expertise became known at Aiken, his services were in great demand. The number of computer science majors at Harvard is relatively small. Each year, about 30 students get their undergraduate degrees in computer science, but they pride themselves on being more well-rounded than their counterparts down the street at MIT. Robert may have had an unusual aptitude, but he was certainly no freak. Everyone around him had a dozen other interests. The spirit of a place like Aiken was personified by the students who worked there as part-time staff programmers. One professor who needed a student to do some programming for him was amazed by what he saw. There the student sat, and as he waited for output from the computer, he appeared to be reading two books at once, one in French and one in German, just to keep himself occupied. Perhaps what made Robert stand out most was his impressive knowledge of Unix. He could sit for hours just reading Unix manuals. The Unix documentation had grown to consist of more than 2,000 pages, and on each page was a new set of minutiae concerning the workings of the operating system. Most people kept the manuals on hand purely for reference, but Robert appeared to enjoy simply reading them. Before long, he was regarded as the most knowledgeable Unix technician on campus, and he had more than a theoretical understanding. He had a tremendous capacity for remembering details. If someone had a question about Unix, it was often easier to just ask Robert than look it up. While some people were in awe of his capacity for minutiae, others wondered if that was all he thought about. He was, in computer parlance, a systems hacker through and through. Like his father, Robert was especially talented at putting together a quick program that would solve a pressing problem. On one occasion, when a professor got a new computer, he needed some software written for it. He asked Robert if he could do it, and without needing to pick up a pen to sketch an outline of the program first, Robert sat down at the computer and just typed. He was finished within a few hours, and the program, while not the most refined of code, certainly did the job. By the end of his freshman year, Robert was spending almost all of his time at Aiken. He was doing odd programming jobs and technical support, all of it gratis, and he had become indispensable. When others asked him why he didn't apply for a job at Aiken so that he could at least get paid, Robert replied that his father had told him not to take a job right away so that he could concentrate on his schoolwork. This way, he could keep to his word but still have fun at Aiken. And since he wasn't on the payroll, he could work on projects of his own choosing. Robert spent the summer of his freshman year living at home in Millington and working at Bell Labs. A second technical paper came from the summer's work, calling attention to a security hole in Berkeley Unix. By this time, Robert's expertise was so well appreciated at Harvard that a special data line was set up between Harvard and the research machine at Bell Labs so that Robert could perform remote diagnostics and maintenance from New Jersey during the summer. Robert's notes were always terse, and they almost always fixed the problem. Even when he wasn't asked directly for help, he offered it anyway. For example, while browsing around the Aiken system, he noticed that some hardware had been installed improperly. A message showed up in Nick Horton's mailbox one day, "Try swapping the two boards in position A and B." It was from Robert. The problem was fixed. When it came time to declare his major, Robert started out in math, but soon switched to computer science. In the first semester of his sophomore year at Harvard, he was hired as a staff programmer. He wasn't actually doing much more than he had done when he worked for no pay, but now he spent even more time at Aiken, to the exclusion of nearly all else, including his coursework. His academic performance fell to the point where the college ordered him to take 1985 off. Rather than tell his parents right away that he was in trouble with Harvard, Robert lined up a full-time job as a programmer at Convex, a hot new computer company in Dallas, and presented the news of academic probation to his parents as a problem for which he already had the solution. Once again, while in Dallas, Robert was a remote diagnostician and consultant for Aiken. When Nick Horton asked him a technical question, he would send back not just a paragraph of explanation, but a lengthy example and tutorial. While at Convex, Robert helped run the company's time-sharing systems and wrote software that would analyze and simulate the performance of Convex hardware. He was also flown out to customer sites as the company's troubleshooting whiz kid. It was a pretty lonely time for someone so young and so shy. When people gave him projects to do, he invariably finished them early and waited for something else to do. Outside of work, he learned rock climbing and scuba diving, and he played Photon, a high-tech version of Capture the Flag. When he went to visit his friends at Aiken, he said he was looking forward to coming back. One of the conditions of Robert's return to Harvard in early 1986 was that he not work again on the Aiken staff, at least not right away. So although he continued to spend time there, he was no longer a formal employee. The Aiken staff came and went, but in early 1986, the esprit de corps was especially strong, and the group especially diverse. There were Nick Horton, a psychology major and social activist, Andy Suddoth, a tall, red-haired Olympic rower, Steve Coffer, captain of Harvard's fencing team and in the midst of starting a software company, Karen Busey, on her way to law school, and David Hendler, one of Robert's closest friends, a linguist and history of science major. It was a group that somehow clicked together particularly well. Doing things outside the lab, taking trips to museums, going on ski vacations, and eating dinner together. They all knew a lot about computers, but they also knew a lot about other things. David was a gourmet cook who found some of his best recipes on the Usenet cookbook, a network recipe exchange. Nick Horton was also an avid subscriber to the Recipe Exchange, and, as a Christmas present one year, Nick printed out the archives of the cookbook, bound it, and sent it to everyone at the lab. Around his friends at Aiken, Robert's shyness melted away. Engaged in technical discussion, Robert was quite animated. In his element, he could be positively expansive. Working at Aiken meant keeping irregular hours and adjusting to a hectic and occasionally demanding environment. Aiken staffers did so uncomplainingly. Dozens of computer startups were eager to use places like Aiken as a testbed for their new hardware and software. There was also a push among the Aiken staff and some of the faculty to procure equipment that was new and interesting, if not entirely reliable. The popular sentiment was that if it didn't work, then it could be made to work. So Aiken staffers spent a lot of their time trying to fix things. If there was a problem in an area that no one knew anything about, someone would volunteer to become an expert in the course of an evening. Robert always managed to find time for some harmless pranks. Exploiting people's tendency to type meal by mistake when asking for their electronic mail, Robert wrote a program so that each time someone made the error, instead of mail, a Dungeons and Dragons-like adventure game appeared on the screen. He excluded senior faculty members from the prank, When they made the typing error, the system simply said it did not recognize the command. The meal prank was clever and harmless, but after a while people became annoyed with the game, and Robert was told to remove it from the system. Then, as an April Fool's joke, Robert wrote a program that made it appear to anyone who logged in that Harvard had gone back in time 10 years and was using a long obsolete operating system on equally obsolete hardware. Whenever Robert was asked if he was the source of a prank, he would look down with a shy smirk. Then there was the Oracle. Anyone logging on to the computer was told to ask any question of the Oracle. But before the question could be asked, a question from the Oracle had to be answered first. Some questions tested one's knowledge of technical trivia. Others were just silly. Why do we have 8:30 a.m. classes? It took everyone a while to figure out that it wasn't the computer itself generating questions, but others using the system. Whenever someone logged on, he or she fulfilled the computer's request to ask a question, which was sent on to the next person to log on. That person's answer was mailed to the user who posed the question, and so on. The Oracle's cleverness lay in making it look as if the computer were doing everything, when in reality, people were both asking and answering questions, and the computer was just mailing messages back and forth. Those who knew Robert well were aware that he had a special interest in computer security. He wasn't one to boast about his computer security expertise, but it helped to explain his preoccupation with studying Unix line by line. Careful examination of the code itself was the best way to unearth security flaws. But he didn't flaunt his detailed knowledge of the operating system, and he certainly didn't announce plans to follow a career in security. Nonetheless, one of his favorite refrains was how many holes there were in Berkeley Unix. At the same time, Robert had a sense for where to draw the line when probing security. Once, he and David Hendler were discussing a particular way of logging into machines around the network. Taken with the notion, David considered logging into Brian Reed's computer at Digital Equipment Research Laboratory in Palo Alto, but Robert advised him strongly against doing that. David knew Reed for his network recipe exchange, but Robert knew him to be an especially conscientious network sentinel who would notice something amiss immediately if someone logged into his computer. Robert made a practice of breaking into only the computers of people he knew wouldn't mind.